I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
Did we get Roz and Mocha? Are they standing by?
Roz and Mocha, join us live.
Roz and Mocha are very famous. Everybody
the most
talks
famous.
About them.
Roz and Mocha.
We could not miss the chance to talk to Roz and Mocha.
Roz and Mocha. Roz and Mocha.
Roz and Mocha.
Brent's making a new show, so if we screw up today, then you can yell at Roz.
Thanks, bro.
Yell at the boss. The boss is the one that let us loose on these microphones.
I'm sure a lot of people thought I was out of my mind.
Two opposites.
When did I become the not fun guy?
Who started from the bottom.
My only focus was going to be to get on the radio.
But my problem was is that I had such incredible stage fright. Everything about having an audience terrified me.
And built one of the biggest radio shows in the country.
Sorry.
This is the story they've never told.
The year before we started this show, I was in a very different place in my life. I was a broken, broken person.
A story of friendship.
Are you serious? Oh my God, that's such great news!
So,
my God, look at me, I'm tearing up, that's such great news!
Family.
I love my wife so much, and we're having a kid.
You are, I've said this since the day I met you, you are going to be one of the greatest fathers the world has ever seen.
Oh, thanks, man.
Comedy. And controversy. All hell broke loose.
The stories about the boycott.
We got a letter from like Jay-Z's lawyers.
I think it would have gotten really nasty.
Basically, they were going to destroy us.
There was a massive, massive deal at the time.
And the pursuit of a shared vision.
For me, the ultimate goal in everything is to just put heart into it.
All the epic moments.
Oh my God, breaking news.
The tears.
No! Are you serious? Oh my God.
I cried a lot.
And damn it, Maury.
Our producer, Maury.
Every time Mocha says his name, it's always, damn it, Maury.
He always does something in the studio to piss me off.
I knew that he would be extremely popular on the show.
The waterfall is the most important thing. It's made out of chocolate germs and all.
A journey of laughter. And the ridiculous.
We're going to be flicking panties.
One, two, three,
flick.
The best there is! The best there was! The best there ever will be! What?
Told by the people who were there.
I guess there's, you know, sure there's by the book there was risk.
So that part was good because I would have been heartbroken if he wanted to leave.
I was confident that we could get a deal here. Given that they both wanted him so badly, he had tremendous leverage.
I would say it is a show centered around two people who care deeply about each other, about their families, and about making you laugh.
And by the ones you've never heard on the show until now.
Well, my real name is DJ Climax, and it's official because that's what my mom calls me now.
14 years.
I could be brown, I could be blue, I could be violet sky.
Thousands of shows.
Is Mocha a virgin?
I'm not a virgin.
Are you sure?
And 10 million podcast downloads.
Oh, it's an honor for being here. You guys are an institution. Man. I can't believe we got to be in the Roz and Mocha show. Keep doing what you're doing.
All of this for a show that almost never happened.
I immediately said no.
And I was crushed.
He said no.
I felt like the show had already failed and we hadn't even built it yet.
This is the Uncensored.
I don't know how I got the reputation for being the asshole, right?
And Unhinged.
Looking back, I was an asshole.
Yeah, I think that Mocha is far more of an asshole than I am, to be honest with you.
History of Roz and Mocha.
I told you I was gonna do it! All you haters, suck it! Suck it! Suck it! Suck it! Suck it! Wagwan!
So this is it. Episode 1.
Where do you want to start?
Let's start with this. What would your life be without Mocha?
Where would my life be without Mocha? That is a really, really tough question. I don't know if I can answer that right now. Can we come back? I don't want to say the wrong thing. I want to say all the right things. Ask me that later.
Okay. Yeah. We'll come back.
When we just started the
Why don't we just start at the beginning?
This story starts in Toronto's east end of Scarborough, in the now famous neighborhood of Malvern.
Ah, Malvern, my hometown. When my family moved there, it was a brand new community. Everyone was flocking to that part of town because that part of town did not exist. That part of Scarborough did not exist. It was like farmland, just empty. And at that point, it was just me, my mom, Zarina, and my dad, Vern.
The family was growing and we need a bigger home. And Malvern came up and we decided we're moving there. It was a new development. Lots of new families moved in. And so we were very happy.
And we thought it would be a good area for us.
Malvern was a very multicultural. All the Filipinos, all the Trinidadians, all the Guyanese, like my family, all the Sri Lankans, all the Indians. It was like all the big, vast majority. What we know now in the city of Toronto as a multicultural kind of hub. It was like they all went to Scarborough. Man, it was cool. It was so cool. We understood one another when we would tell stories about growing up at home or like the ass whooping that we got at home for this particular reason. You'd be like, oh, damn, you got your ass whooped because of that? So did I.
He was a nice boy. He was really a nice, loving boy.
He was, I would say, a mommy's boy.
Mocha was a really good baby. He was chubby. He was playful. He was an only child for 8 years.
Oh, man. Talking about the good old days. When I was an only child, I thought it was it. I thought it was me, mom, dad. Life was great. Life was easy. I was getting all the attention. I was getting all the stuff. I was being taken everywhere. I got to do all the things. And then my little sister Laura shows up. And I'm like, what the hell? The day that they brought my sister Laura home is another one of those days where it's in my mind. I will never forget.
I remember clearly Laura was a preemie baby. She spent 28 days in the hospital. I brought her home. Mocha was playing in the backyard. And when he saw all the neighbors came over to look at the baby.
I was so pissed. And they put her in that crib. And I snuck up to my parents' room. And I went up to the crib. And I said to her, dead in her sleeping baby face.
He came up and he said to Laura, I wish you were never born. You're getting all the attention.
And I took my hand and I pushed her. I pushed a baby.
I first heard that story. I think I was a teenager at the time. I can't remember the exact age, but yes, apparently he came into the room while I was sleeping in the crib, shoved me and whispered, I wish you were never born, because at that time he was the only child and he was jealous of me.
She was like a month and a bit premature. So she spent the first month or so of her life in an incubator at the hospital. And then it was safe enough to bring her home. And I look at her sleeping so peacefully. And I said, I wish you were never born. And then I pushed her.
I was shocked.
I remember he said it on more than one occasion.
Not hard. It was more like a little, you know, like a nudge.
To me, I don't think he meant it. But maybe at the time, at the spur of the moment, maybe he meant it. But afterwards, he probably regretted it.
No, I think he did. He meant it.
At first, I thought it was quite awful because I was just an infant at the time. But as we got older and he kept telling the story and I kept hearing it, it just became a little joke within the family. And Mocha still says that to me today, telling me he wishes I was never born.
97 kilometers and a world away was Acton, a small picture-perfect blue-collar town an hour outside of Toronto.
I grew up in this small town. And when I say small town, like my high school had like 500 kids in it.
At the time, there was only 5,000 people. I really enjoyed Acton. It was quiet and peaceful at that time. And the kids met a lot of friends and had a great time.
It was your typical like skid, rock and roll, small town Ontario. My family was me, my dad Ralph, my mom Diane, and my big brother Rich.
Richard is 26 months, I believe, older than Roz. And they were inseparable from the time Roz was born.
My brother Richard, we're so incredibly close.
Before I could actually see my brother in the hospital when he was born, I got a picture of him. So before my mom came home, and I carried it around like staring at it, saying, "This is my baby brother. This is my baby brother."
And he would not wear anything that did not have a pocket in it, because he had to carry his little brother around with him.
So this was a special pocket, and it was just for that picture. So he was literally my best friend, and the thing that I looked forward to most before I even met him.
And he got home, and Richard treated him like he was gold. And we let him feed him. He helped change him. The beginning of that closeness was the fact that we allowed Richard to be totally and completely involved.
We would go to stores, and I got to, even before he was born, I got to pick out his toys. You know, my mom said, "Okay, well, what do you want to get?" So I would always go to the store and I would pick out something for him. So I was looking forward to meeting him long before he was born.
They gave so much responsibility to my brother when he was younger to raise me that it almost forced us to bond. Like when we were kids, he was the one that would discipline me if I tried to stick my hand in a light socket or something like that. And it didn't drive us apart. It drove us closer together. And he sort of became my protector. He was always the first one that I knew I could rely on.
With Mocha's dreams of living life as an only child now long gone, his world was about to get rocked yet again when he became the older brother to a second little sister.
You know, this is so bad. Like, I remember that moment with Laura. I don't remember, like, any moment with Lisa.
I'm happy I didn't get shoved, but I'm not surprised that he doesn't remember when I was born, because he still doesn't remember I'm around sometimes.
I am by far the true definition of an older brother of two younger sisters.
He was very protective, always looking out for them.
As I got older, he started getting very protective and wanting to know where I was going, who I was going with. When I was in high school, I would have to be home at a certain time. If not, he would actually come drive and look for me at school. So I was very scared of him, actually. And I made sure that I was at home on time.
I scared the hell out of their friends. Anytime guys were introduced to us, I would do my absolute best to intimidate.
My brother likes to have this intimidating stare about him.
Even Laura said one day, "If I have a boyfriend, I can tell my mom, I can tell my dad, but I can't tell my brother."
Because of how protective he was, and I knew that he didn't like the idea of me having male friends or having a boyfriend. So that's the reason, because I knew that he would probably interrogate my boyfriend.
Oh, when my sister got a boyfriend. Man, I was mean to that guy.
My family didn't know I had a boyfriend, but my brother was suspicious.
I definitely remember him just standing on the driveway with his arms crossed, kind of glaring if he thought my sister was coming home with a boy.
And while I was getting a ride home, my brother was waiting in the garage for me. So I ducked because they didn't know the car. I ducked and I asked my boyfriend at the time to just drop me at the end of the street so my brother couldn't see.
He would call the house. And with my sister sitting next to me, I'd be like, "Who's this?" And he'd say his name. I'd be like, "Who are you looking for?" And then he would say Laura's name. And I'd be like, "Laura doesn't live here. You got the wrong number."
There was one time when we had Laura's 21st birthday. And we had a party and he was there. And after the birthday party, the friends came over to my house and some scuffle happened between Mocha and one of Laura's friends, where he put the boy in a chokehold.
I put a guy in a chokehold. And what? Kid wanted smoke. You don't mess around on my sister's birthday.
He was acting foolish, and my brother and his friends basically grabbed this guy and put him in a chokehold.
And you know, after that party, everyone came back to the house to eat. You know who showed up? Chokehold. He was there sitting at the kitchen table eating Chinese food with everybody there. And like an hour before, I had him in the tightest chokehold ever. Almost killed the guy. I was so mean. I was such a jerk.
I have always been afraid to bring guys home when my brother is around.
Looking back, I was an asshole to my sister's friends. Absolutely.
Yeah, he's just kind of a weirdly scary guy when he's in like big brother protective mode.
But it's all good now. We get along. They are amazing. I love them. And they've grown up to be incredible women.
He continues to be a great big brother to the both of us. He's the best, but he's definitely not the funniest one of the group. I'll tell you that.
When I was a teenager, I had a mustache that looked cool.
Yeah, I remember that. He grew it and I thought maybe he didn't have enough money to buy a razor blade or a shaver. But then eventually I said to him, keep it neat and keep it tidy, well trimmed. But he never bothered to do that. He just wanted it to look the way he wanted it to look. Unkempt a bit.
My mom never said anything about the mustache, so I don't even know how she feels about it.
How come I don't remember this mustache?
You're crazy. I remember it very clearly. But after I spoke to him about it, he used to keep it well trimmed.
I literally blocked it out of my memory because I don't remember anything about the mustache. I do remember how Mocha used to dress.
Oh, my clothes when I was in high school, so baggy.
He would dress ridiculous with his baggy pants and big shirts.
Like baggy everything. Did my parents comment on it? Yes, all the time.
Pants look very baggy. The shirt was hanging on him.
Why are your pants so baggy? Why is that shirt so big on you? Why don't you wear clothes that fit?
At that time, I thought it was part of growing up, part of being a kid.
And his hair was purple sometimes.
I went through different hairstyles. I had like a comb over style, like my dad, right? It was parted to one side and the sides were like slick. So the top was parted over to one side. The sides were slick back. I was like, as a style I got from my dad. My dad still rocks the same style. And then I did a version of my hair where I shaved the sides and the back and kept the top super long and pushed it all the way back. And then I had shaved all my hair off for a really, really long time. So I just went with a bald fade.
I was like, I was a skid, man. You know, it was long hair, tight jeans.
Definitely scarves, tons of bracelets, like lots and lots of silvery gold type of bangles on his arms.
I'd make my own clothes, like, because you couldn't buy rock and roll clothes in the town that I grew up in. So my mom taught me how to sew when I was younger, and I made everything tighter.
What he proceeded to do was take in most of his jeans from thigh to about the knee. He took them in really, really tight, but he left the bottom part of the jeans looser in order to be able to get them around his feet and his legs. And then he would sit with a needle and thread and stitch them up after he put them on. Because it was the only way he could get them on, right? He would have to put them in and then sew them up after. I don't know how he walked actually in them, but he would have to come home. In order to take them off, he had to undo the stitching at the bottom again all the time. And I remember that so well.
My mom just didn't give a shit when it came to things. There was one Halloween where they were busy and everybody just dropped the ball on Halloween, but I needed a costume for school. And my mom sits me down in a chair and starts doing my makeup and then curling my hair. And she goes to her closet and she grabs like a mini dress. And she had these white, high-heeled patent leather boots that came up to the thigh.
And I remember getting up in the morning saying, well, you know, you can always wear my go-go boots and a short skirt. And
she's like, here, wear these. And I was like, okay, cool, no problem.
His feet were the same size as mine when he was in grade 6. So he wore my boots, and I think I cut up an old skirt or something and a top and some beads, whatever. And his hair was long, and he put a headband or whatever on his head. And he went to school like that.
And I was dressed like a woman. And she says to me, if anyone asks, you tell them you're a hooker. My mom sent me to school on Halloween as a hooker. Not a go-go dancer, a hooker.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
When Roz and Mocha both hit their teenage years, they were rebellious in their own ways. But they were doing it in two very different households.
The amount of stuff from high school that my mom has no idea about, I think would make her head explode. Oh my God, the most famous saying from my mom that friends of mine even use is those who don't listen must feel.
Well, those who don't listen must feel, it's a Guyanese slang. In Guyana, when you tell somebody not to do something, they go out there and they do it, then they have to pay the consequences.
And let me tell you, I felt a lot growing up in that household.
I used to love to say that to him because only then I would get them to listen. I would say it and then they would stop and listen. And then they would do whatever I asked them to do.
Listen, immigrant parents, and if you're a child of immigrant parents, you know whatever country they came from, their parents gave ass whoopings. And the parents, when they came here, would continue the tradition of ass whoopings.
Okay, come on, say it as you used to say it.
Those who don't listen have to feel.
And it was like that feel, the word feel, is where you put the emphasis on. Those who don't listen must feel. Like you say it with force. And at that point, you know, oh man, I'm going to feel this one for sure.
Those who don't listen have to feel.
My mom and dad, the house that they ran was, first of all, it was fun, but it was sort of no bullshit, right? And that was the one thing that they would not handle is they wouldn't handle lying.
Don't ever lie. Because if you lie and we find out about it, you are going to be punished to the height. Okay. But if you screw up and you tell us you screwed up, then we'll help you fix it.
But my dad was, you know, he was a recovering alcoholic, but I was too young to remember him when he was a drunk. So I never saw that side of him, right? But he was just kind and super gentle, which was weird because he was, you know, he was in the Marines and he did two tours in Vietnam.
He spent 26 months in Vietnam and left, just had enough. That's I'm not doing this anymore.
Growing up, my dad was the only person I knew who had killed somebody. Right. And that when you're young, that's an incredible realization, you know, that you like all that stuff that you're exposed to when you're a kid, G.I. Joe and war movies and, you know, Platoon and like all of this stuff, you know, it hits so different for me because I knew that sort of my dad lived that and it wasn't fantasy and it wasn't entertainment.
And it took years for him to be able to feel comfortable about himself.
You know, what's crazy is I used to lie about getting spanked. Because I thought it made me fit in with other kids a little bit better. But I never did. My father, who was raised through violence, right? That was sort of his upbringing.
He grew up in a home where both his parents were alcoholic and he had a terrible, terrible childhood. And I was bound and determined to make sure that this relationship with me and with any future kids and family would be something that he would enjoy and he would cherish. And that's exactly what we did.
He didn't run a house with his fist. He ran it with fear.
Threats of what would happen if you screwed up were always pretty high on, especially his list.
And the only thing my old man ever said to me and my brother was, listen, you're going to get to a point where you think you can do it. And if you think you can do it, let me know because we'll take you outside. We'll go to the backyard and the first person whose back hits the ground first loses. And I guarantee you it won't be me.
I remember him telling the boys stories, how he could in one swift hit, break their nose or choke them or put them under.
I was never afraid of being hit by my dad. I was afraid that I was one day going to have to fight my dad. And that's different.
And they always believed him, which really surprised me because he was so gentle. He was a really, really gentle soul.
Out of all the differences in the way both Roz and Mocha grew up, none was more apparent or more opposite than when it came to sex.
Sex was never a discussion in our house. My parents never had to talk with me.
That is true. We never had to talk. We never talked about sex with him.
Yeah, that's true. We never did.
We didn't think that it was necessary.
Everything I learned was from, like, not even school, just like talking to friends, right? Because I went to a Catholic high school, actually elementary school as well. So they don't teach you sex ed.
Because I thought that he probably would learn that in school, even from friends in the playground.
Everything I learned was, you know, as they say in the streets, right? That's how I learn everything. Even as an adult, sex does not come up in our household. Are you nuts?
That's not something that we're accustomed to talking to our kids about.
You want me to get an ass whooping from my parents as an adult? And I'm saying that as a father.
He never asked about sex or where babies came from. I don't remember. I don't recall.
No, the sex talk does not happen at all.
We never indulge in conversations with him about that. He never asked us about that or about sex.
My mom's ballsy, man. She was the best mom for teenage boys because there was never any censorship around saying anything. And I remember having these conversations about, you know, sex with my mom when we were like inappropriately young.
Sex was always a very open subject in the house. They were never afraid to ask any questions whatsoever. They always knew they were going to get a truthful answer. And then, of course, the girlfriends started coming around. And then you kind of get a little bit like, uh-oh.
I remember a dinner, and my brother will tell you, we were sitting at the dinner table one night when we were both teenagers, and one of us made mention of maybe having a girlfriend. And my mom's reaction to that was, you should just sleep around.
Which sounds bizarre. And depending on what day you ask my mom, she would probably not necessarily recall the exact same way that it was told to us.
Why do you want to tie yourself down to, you know, one girl? You guys should be out there sleeping around.
So I remember I probably said, just sleep around because you're too young to be settled down with one girlfriend right now.
And I never knew another mom who said that to her sons. You guys should be out there sleeping around, right? Like, it was crazy.
But the idea behind it was don't settle for any one thing too soon. Like, whatever it is that you're going through right now, and the people that you're with, or the girls that you're gonna fall in love with, I'm sure they're fantastic, but this is a new experience and you need to have as many experiences as possible. So you need to expose yourself to as many things in that respect as possible.
And I think they took that the wrong way. I quite didn't mean just sleep around. And if you were going to sleep around, then make sure you were careful. That's all. I know we did say that. If that's what it comes down to, just make sure you're careful.
Did I ever bring girls home? Not as many, but yes, I did.
On a few occasions, he did bring girls, but I didn't think it was girlfriends. He said they were friends. At that time, I did believe him because he had lots of friends, boys and girls, and they all used to come to my house.
There were times we would have people over and I would just tell my folks that we're ordering pizza and we are going to watch a movie and everything's going to be cool. They don't need to be home. Maybe go out from party start time and come back like 3 hours later. And they were totally cool with that.
I didn't take much of it because I believed him. They were his friends, school friends, and he brought them home and they were playing games at home. So at that time, I did believe him.
But at some point after they left, some of the kids that would come over would like venture off into different rooms of the house.
I'm now hearing this. I didn't know about that. So that's a surprise to me. My goodness.
I'm surprised, really. At that time, we were unaware of it at that time.
You can go to the den, but don't touch any of my dad's stuff. He's got a lot of accounting stuff in there. I never made out with anybody in either of my sister's rooms and not in my parents' rooms. My God, never.
Yes, it does make me feel better that my bedroom was off limits.
Hey, yeah, I agree.
My mother would be horrified. I think my mother, if she knew that girls were sneaking around in the house, she would be mortified. And let me make one thing clear. When I was having my friends over and we were hanging out, whatever, zero sex took place. I don't want my parents to think that any of that was going down because it never, absolutely never, never, never did.
Oh my goodness. Thank God.
Yeah. Can you imagine that?
I was playing in bands when I was younger. So my dad built us this soundproof studio in the basement for me and my band. And it was only a matter of time before my shithead friends realized that, you know, they had access to a soundproof room with mirrors all along one wall. And so the room that my dad thought he built for me and my band was actually the neighborhood orgy room. And and it got used quite a bit. And he had, you know, he had no idea. He had no idea. Maybe they did know. I don't know. Maybe my mom, if you asked my mom if she knew what the orgy room was, she would have an answer for that.
I personally don't think there was too much else going on, but then I'm just a mom, so I can't guarantee you what else might have been going on down there at the time.
But my brother sure as hell knew what the orgy room was.
When you're that old, your job is to hide things, right? So your parents aren't supposed to know everything that goes on in the house, quite literally beneath their feet.
So maybe I'm in denial.
But that was sort of my house growing up.
Soundproof room in the basement. That's what's going to happen.
Like, my dad ran a very, very strict household.
When it came to rules in the house, yes, it was very strict. There was no TV from Monday to Friday. It was just homework.
Homework and schoolwork was always like number one.
And on top of the school homework, Mukha's dad gave them extra work to do and it had to be done.
If I wasn't doing well in a subject, like, my dad was the dad that would either give me homework that he like made up on his own, mainly math, because I sucked at math. My dad's an accountant, so he wanted me to excel in math.
So yeah, I used to give him extra assignments to do, for instance, like tables or reading assignments. We thought at that time it was for his benefit.
My dad is probably like the smartest guy I know. And he like ran through all of the schools and universities in Guyana and in England with like top grades. The days I had to bring home a bad report card were like the worst days of my life.
He, for some reason, did not like math. And he said, in this world, you don't need maths to have a job.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That upset me quite a bit.
I could tell he was disappointed. And he will either say that he's disappointed or he would let his silence maybe show the disappointment where I would feel guilty.
I felt that maths was important because you need maths in every walk of life. It helps you. And I said, we have to do something about it. So I helped them out with this maths as much as I can at that time.
I don't know if like his secretly, like, although he never said it, I just always got the sense that he thought that if I killed it at math, that I could be an accountant. And then like maybe his dream was for us to be like a father-son accountant duo.
Yes, I did have dreams about Mukha joining me in accounting. I had my dreams that we would start this business together and he will be my right-hand person.
And like just kill the game, right? And open up like our own practice and kind of like rule the accounting world.
Oh, yes. I did even have a name picked out for the business, like Vern's Accounting, Vern's and Son Accounting. But he also had dreams. He had his own dreams. His dream was in music and in radio. And I'm happy about that.
My house was full of my friends constantly. My friends would come over and hang out with my mom and dad even when I wasn't home.
I was constantly feeding other kids. I never knew how many people were going to have at my table for dinner. And the kids always knew if they came over, they could get something to eat, especially if their mom and dad weren't home and there was nothing in the house and nobody had cooked dinner. They knew they would always get fed, for one.
My parents didn't really seem to be the same kind of parents that my friends had.
They were so dialed in to the drama that was happening with everybody I knew that everybody knew, everybody thought of my parents as their parents. They called them mom and dad.
I think there was a trust level there rather than, oh, well, they're just not going to fluff us up. We treated them like they were people and not kids.
Anybody who would come to the house felt like they were engaging with people who treated them like they were real human beings and not potential human beings.
Troy was one of those guys that would be at my house constantly, right? Like Troy was one of those guys that would sit at the kitchen table and just have coffee with my, you know, my mom and dad and just talk. And my dad loved Troy.
Roz's dad, Ralph, was an amazing guy.
My dad understood young men who were frustrated. My mom understood young women who never felt heard. And my house was the place where they could feel understood.
When I was 14, my father had passed, and he knew my situation. And he was always ready with really good advice when I needed it. Advice I wasn't getting elsewhere.
My dad loved kicking it with us, right? Like that's one of the things that he loved more than anything. And Troy was one of the best people to just kick it with.
You felt like part of the family when you were certainly talking to Ralph.
Troy was a big part of my life, and he was a big part of my dad's life, and he was a big part of our family. And it was really beautiful. Like even to this day, I still get messages from people talking about how great my parents were to them.
To this day, all those kids still call me mom.
Growing up in a small town, you don't know what options are out there because you just don't think that options really exist.
Ross always wanted to be famous.
You know, in my own head, like I was famous then. It's just nobody knew it, right?
When he was a teenager, he thought, hey, I'm going to be a rock star. That's one of the reasons we built the soundproof room that turned into an orgy room, apparently.
But my problem was is that I had such incredible stage fright my whole life that everything about having an audience terrified me.
While the idea of radio slipped farther and farther from Ross's reach, Mocha had already made up his mind, regardless of the cost.
The biggest mistake that I made in high school was making the decision at 16 that my only focus was going to be to get on the radio.
I remember when he fell in love with radio because he was in Pope John Paul High School. He was in the music. He was a drummer. He was on the song crew. And that's when I knew that music is his passion.
Because I just, at that point, abandoned any other potential for if I didn't make it on the radio, then what the hell was I going to do? There was zero plan B.
Yes, I remember also when we used to talk to his music teacher at parent-teachers meeting. I was a bit worried and about music and about pursuing that sort of avenue. But the music teacher said, you know, if he's doing well, leave him, just encourage him, let him follow his passion. Let him follow his dream.
So it started at a very, very young age. And like my goal back then was to like to be, it wasn't necessarily like to talk on the radio, but it was more like to be a DJ, like spinning the records. I'd say, especially in high school growing up, my love for like hip hop, R&B, dancehall kind of came into play. So I started collecting vinyl at a very young age. I think I was like 10 years old when I got my first vinyl that I actually bought with my own money. So it was very like hip hop R&B oriented. Wu-Tang Clan, Notorious B.I.G., Tribe Called Quest, Busta Rhymes is another great example. On the R&B side, it was like Mary J. Blige and SWV and stuff that like, you know, early Usher days, Method Man and Ghostface and Raekwon and all that kind of stuff is what I was like really heavy into. I got my first set of turntables when I was like 16.
I bought the turntable for him and he had lots of records, the vinyl records. And quite often I have to remind him to turn the volume down.
At that time, it was like radio and that was it.
Quite often I would bang on the door, yes, and remind him to keep the volume down. He would go bang, 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 bang. Kindly turn it down, please turn it down. He will turn it down for a moment, then after a few minutes, it goes back up again.
This had to work out because if it didn't, I didn't have a fallback.
I treated it as something he's doing for school. It's just his passion. He liked it. And we encouraged him. And that's the beginning of the story.
I didn't realize at the time that I was going through like any sort of mental health issues. I'd never even heard those two words put together like that. And I didn't know if I was like messed up or completely normal. I was self-harming and my self-confidence was like non-existent at that point. And I was just afraid. But like every kid at that time, you just have this weight on you. And it's like, well, what do you want to do with your life? I applied for radio college, not because I had some deep desire to get into radio, but it was really one of the only places that I thought I could get into. And I applied to one school and one school only, and I got in, and it was Humber College.
Graduated high school, like barely passed, right? Again, because I was just so focused on this that I kind of abandoned some of the other classes. And like all things, you know, back in high school, like I look back at now and I'm like, you idiot. Like those are actually pretty important to what you do for a living right now. So I graduated and I applied to the radio broadcasting program at Seneca College. And at that time, you had to take a test to get in. So I took the test. I failed the test. And then I was like, oh shit. For like a split second, I was like, well, I'll just like take a gap. Like I won't go to school. I'll take a gap year and then take the test again. Well, I had to tell my folks that I failed and I couldn't get into this program that I really wanted. And my dad was like, well, you got to go to school, do something.
I thought the best thing for him was to continue with the program again, redo his courses and continue with it. I didn't think that taking a year off would be beneficial for him. He agreed and he continued on.
Took the test again and passed that one. I still knew, like the year one, they teach you a little bit of radio and TV. For me, I knew it was radio and radio only.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
In the mid-90s, both Roz and Mocha found themselves in New York City.
I was at Humber for 1 year, and I left because I got this opportunity to go to New York and intern on the Howard Stern Show. And it was a once-in-a-lifetime kind of opportunity. And I got myself an interview with this woman named Kathy Tobin.
So I was the Stern Show office manager, internship coordinator, and Howard's assistant from 1992 through 2000.
I'd never been out of the country before. And my first time out of the country was on a Greyhound going to New York. And she was so wonderful and so kind. And I had all this, you know, these thoughts in my head of what the Stern Show was like.
This was the early 90s. We had a very small staff. The show was blowing up. Howard had just written his first book. He also ran for governor that year. There was a lot going on.
They had never had a Canadian kid apply to be an intern on that show before. And so she was just blown away by like, what the hell are you even doing here?
He had a really good sense of humor. He didn't have an agenda like most of the interns that came in to apply. He was wide open and he was ready to take direction.
I knew that if I was going to learn, I had to learn from the best. And to me, that was the best. It was the biggest show that I could think of in the world, was the Howard Stern Show.
Because I was so determined, I started looking at radio stations to see if I can get an internship after my year one of college. And nobody was looking for interns. And then I contacted some places in New York City only because I have like a ton of family in New York. And I was like, if I could get a spot, like an internship in New York, at least I have a place to stay for free, right? And within a week, one of the two stations contacted me and said, hey, we could use an intern. Are you willing to come back and spend the summer? And I was like, absolutely. So I was there from like morning until, I'm talking like 11 o'clock at night.
When I was at Stern, I was supposed to be there for quite a while. And I wound up leaving early because I just, it didn't feel right. And I didn't know who I was. I was lonely and it wasn't good for me. I was drowning as opposed to thriving.
I had no idea that he was depressed and self-harming during the time that he was interning for us. I just thought he was quiet. I wish I had known that he needed help and that I could have pointed him in the right direction.
When you're that far in it, the one thing that you don't want to do, and at least for me anyways, I never wanted to burden anyone with it, right?
He just seemed like he was such a together guy and just sad, you know, that he went through so much.
I was going through a lot of mental health stuff at the time and I didn't know what it was that I was trying to process, but I knew I was not going to figure it out alone in New York.
When he walked away from the Howard Stern Show, Roz rebuilt a life in Toronto that was safe, healthy, and full of opportunity. He moved back in with his brother, refocused, and got to work.
I came back from New York and I immediately wanted to sort of work in radio. And that's when I met Paul Cook.
I started working with Roz in a freelance capacity, and he just had this vibe about him.
Paul was like a news reader, but he was also an executive producer of this public affairs and news show. And he hired me.
He was very worldly in his approach to things. And we talked about every single issue you could imagine. And I thought, this guy has a ton of potential.
Paul was the first person who legitimately looked at me and saw potential. And I've never forgot that. And to me, that was the opportunity that I was waiting for, you know, was really somebody to believe in me.
He was also really good looking. He was almost too good looking. Right? Like he was a good looking dude. And anyway, that's not why I hired him, but I saw a ton of potential in him because he had an unbelievable curiosity and he was funny as hell.
I was by far the youngest person who worked on that show, and I was living a much different life than everybody who worked on that show.
He's low key. He's not high maintenance. He doesn't. And I knew, you know, the hosts of the show were very demanding broadcasters. And I just knew that he was going to fly below the radar, not get in their way.
I would be out at clubs all night.
I know there were probably nights where he didn't sleep. I know there were the occasional mornings where he was at work in the same clothing that he wore the day before. So, you know, he didn't go home.
Just dancing and drinking. Those were some years where I put like miles on my body.
You know, he would work in the daytime and then nighttime he would go out and do his thing.
I don't know if anybody knew how hard I was partying during that time.
And then he would come back to the station and answer calls and return calls in the office at night. Like he worked around the clock. There wasn't much separation between personal life and work life with Roz.
I had gone to radio college and I went and worked for Howard Stern, but I didn't actually love radio until I started working for Paul. Paul was the one that made me sort of fall in love with radio.
You know, we can't tell the story of Roz and Mocha without telling the story of Kiss 92.5. And we can't tell that story without Julie Adam.
The history of KISS is a fun one. Essentially, it was a new radio station coming to Toronto at 92.5.
You're listening to the home of new country, KISS FM, 92.5.
Throughout much of the 90s, KISS was a country station.
Because of you, KISS is now the number one country radio station in the world. More people listen to country right here in Toronto than anywhere else. Los Angeles.
And KISS was, as a country station, was massive.
Toronto is number one.
92.5 KISS FM.
K-K-I-S-S-S. On February 5th, 1999, KISS Country was killed off and KISS 92 was born.
A group of executives from Rogers came in and told the staff that they had purchased the station.
Sorry.
And were in the process of changing it to Top 40.
You gotta admit, it's catchy.
Kiss 92.
And the rest was history.
Kiss. Kiss. Kiss.
A true Top 40 powerhouse that would shake the market. Led by Mad Dog and Billy in the Morning.
Mad Dog and Billy!
Okay, so I moved into my new place last night.
Right.
Brought my parents down. I'll just give you the quick version. So I call my parents and I'm all excited. I finally got a place, guys. I love it. It's right downtown, blah, blah, blah.
Mad Dog came from Halifax and Billy was doing weekends. And that's how it started. Like they had amazing chemistry. They were really funny together. And so Mad Dog and Billy became the show.
Mad Dog and Billy in the Morning.
Now read the first line.
Kiss 92 FM.
I'm Billie Holiday. I co-hosted the Mad Dog and Billy show from 2000 to 2007.
You know, just fun and goofing off. That was always the mission of Kiss Mornings, was to have fun.
KISS was something that was new to Toronto that was just this amazing force to be reckoned with.
You know, cause harmless trouble, get noticed, and try to do something that, you know, wasn't already being done in the market.
So it was wild, and it just felt so good. We were all in our 20s, lots of energy, worked and partied really hard.
So we treated it a bit like a startup and wanted to build something new.
One of our professors was a consultant that worked for the company that was helping to make the transition to KISS as a Top 40 station, and said to us the day that the station was going to switch, like a couple hours before, was like, hey, listen to this frequency, 92.5 at 5 p.m. There's going to be a big change in the marketplace. And I remember listening that weekend, and I had a friend in the car, and I said to him, I'm going to work at that radio station one day.
Well, I can go back to the very first time I met Mocha. In 1999, you know, this young guy would call me.
Once a week for 3 weeks. Actually, maybe more than once a week. Maybe let's say twice a week for 3 weeks. I called her and said, hey, it's me again. Do you have anything open, willing to do absolutely anything?
And then one day, I got a phone call from reception who said, there's a young guy out here to see you. And it was Mocha.
I had a friend who was already working there and he was going into the radio station that day, and I decided to follow him, and I had my resume with me and I like wore a tie and everything, and with the intention of meeting Julie so I could give her my resume and be like, hey, I want to work here. It was the most unprofessional thing I'd ever done in my entire life. I can confidently say I'm very proud of that moment. I can't even finish the sentence.
And he said, I thought I would show up and see if you had a job for me. And so I basically said to him, hey, if you can learn the equipment, you know, you're hired.
I was like, absolutely. And I had no idea. I forgot everything. I was lost. And she's like, okay, your first shift is tonight, like at midnight.
And Mocha said, I'm in.
And I screwed everything up. The station was like not on time whatsoever. I was hitting all sorts of wrong buttons.
So when you can take work ethic, which he has, integrity and team spirit, and package that all up into a person. To me, that's the kind of person you want to work with every day of the week.
I told Julie that I wanted to be on the air. And at the time, there were no spots available. And I was still like so fresh. And then she said, it's not much, but I can offer you like a 2 to 4 a.m. and then still produce the morning show Monday to Friday. So I was basically working 7 days a week.
With Mocha already on the roster, he would become Mad Dog and Billy's first producer. Mad Dog
and Billy! Yo, what's happening, guys?
What's going on, buddy?
Not much. Chilling on the corner.
It's the continuing adventures of Mocha Frappuccino. Today, Mocha, your assignment is what?
Well, I guess we named it a streetcar called Mocha.
A streetcar named Mocha.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, screw up my title, man. I was up all night writing that.
Mocha was always such a joy to work with. He was always so happy to be there, happiest guy in the room. Always had a big smile on his face.
And that is Mocha, you know, team player.
And then from there, the story kind of just continued.
He's kind of willing to do anything. And he's so likable. And really, he's such a good human being.
I produced for Mad Dog and Billy, I think it was like 2 years. Reason why I had to leave Mad Dog and Billy was to do a permanent 5-day, like a weekday shift overnight, midnight to 5:30. The entire time I worked with Mad Dog and Billy, I wanted to be on the radio, have my own show. That was like the goal from the very beginning.
With Mocha taking on a bigger role at the station, Mad Dog and Billy needed a new producer.
I didn't really know a lot about KISS because I just wasn't in that world. I was in the news world, but I knew that Billy worked for KISS and I had gone to college with Billy.
So it was the early 90s. Roz and I hit it off immediately, actually. We had kind of the same sense of humor and same love of music. And yeah, we got along really super well and just kept in touch all this time.
And at that time, the show that I was working on at the time was ending. I knew it was going to be canceled and my marriage was ending and my father was dying. And I needed an escape and I needed help and I needed somebody to sort of rescue me from that point that I was in at the time. And that's when Billy got a hold of Julie.
I really pushed for Roz to be on the show because he's always been so uber talented and he was a very close friend of mine. And I just thought he'd be a great fit.
I had a meeting with him in my office and I think I hired him on the spot. I just knew this is the guy. This is the guy.
And so I met with Julie and I told, you know, Julie in the meeting, hey, listen, just so you know, my dad's dying. So in a couple of weeks, I'm going to need time off, everything else. And they gave me the opportunity and Julie hired me, a.k.a. Julie saved me.
I remember Roz having to go through this trauma of losing your dad at such a young age. I mean, he was young. Roz was young. His dad was young.
I have to tell you a little bit about Ralph. In 2001, he was diagnosed with mesothelioma, which is cancer caused from overexposure to asbestos. He was diagnosed in October and he passed away in June. So it was only like, what, 8 months, 9 months, I guess. Both the boys took it really hard, of course. That was their dad and they were really, really close to him.
You know, you really understand how much of that shaped Roz over the following years.
Looking back, I know he was going through a lot and he was a great friend because he would always listen to my shit, even though he was going through so much shit himself. And I'll never forget his dad's funeral. And he just looked at me and just grabbed my hand and he said, thank you.
That job is exactly what I needed at that right time.
Roz was able to do this. And I think performers in general, they can kind of compartmentalize their lives and their performances. And miraculously, you know, they don't necessarily bleed into each other. So while he was struggling personally, you know, he was able to sort of flip a switch and come to work and do the job that he needed to do. And you'd never know. You'd never know that he was going through all of these things.
And I was a broken person, but you know, your job is to go in and have fun. And so you just never let it show, right? Like I never let it show. And that was a wild show to work on.
You know, that radio station and that show was all about having fun and goofing off. And, you know, he was hired to be funny and hired to write funny things and hired to do goofy things.
You come up with these stupid ideas, man. And it was Thanksgiving. I had this idea that why should turkeys be the only ones who don't get to appreciate Thanksgiving dinner? And so I had this idea that I was going to bring in a live turkey, which we did. And it was sitting in a cage in the studio. And I wanted to see if a turkey would eat turkey.
The turkey did. The phone lines blew up.
People were not happy with this idea of Roz's.
What a dumb idea. And it was so funny. And I remember when that idea came forward and, you know, laughing about it. And I don't know why I said yes to these things. I mean, in hindsight, that's ridiculous.
I've never had a more negative reaction to anything I have ever done, ever. People were furious.
They were cleaning the station. They were emailing. Apparently, people don't like cannibalism, I guess, or eating your own.
And I didn't think about that at the time, right? I really didn't. To me, it was funny. And so that was my first taste of, you know, when you go so far in one direction and it can just go so bad for you. And that feeding turkey to a turkey went so bad for me. It went so bad for me.
I spent the majority of my time taking calls from people who didn't like what was said, didn't like what was done, didn't understand it. You know, some of those calls were from my boss. Some of those calls are from my boss's boss. That was my part-time job, my side hustle.
On June 4th, 2003, the party ended.
When I first started hearing the rumors that KISS was going away, I was like, there is no way that this is going away because this is everyone loves this station.
And just like that, KISS was done. At 4 p.m., KISS 92.5 became Jack FM.
Toronto's newest radio station, 92.5 Jack FM, playing what we want.
I thought we were like totally a solid morning show that no one was going to lose their jobs. We would be there forever. Like, KISS was going to be there forever.
And Mocha's dream job was over.
When KISS switched to Jack FM, I didn't know that it was going to happen. I kind of found out with the rest of the staff. I believe we were in a boardroom.
As radio programmers or as people who are overseeing the radio stations is to build the biggest audience you can. I mean, that was always the mission. And the KISS audience was smaller at the time. And this Jack radio station was on fire in Vancouver, and the company wanted to give it a go in Toronto.
When it happened, I just remember immediately going to have drinks with Roz, because I think that we did that a lot in pain and in, you know, to celebrate. So I was devastated. KISS was my life.
When KISS came to an end, God, that sucked. That was the worst. That was the worst.
I was so young that I didn't get it. I didn't think I'd ever recover. And it was just such a special time in radio and such a special radio station. It was one of a kind.
Because KISS was my favorite radio station in the entire world, that's where I started my career. That's where I've always wanted to work at. I took it so personal that as soon as we left that meeting, I walked down the hall and I punched a hole through the wall. And I think I had tears running down my eyes at the time.
I remember Mocha being very upset and, you know, heard afterwards about him punching a wall, which, you know, I felt horrible.
It was no secret that I made that hole in the wall. Like, I told everyone. People asked who made the hole in the wall. And I was like, yo, that was me that made the hole in the wall. I was pissed.
I mean, you don't ever get into this business to have to, you know, tell a team of people who have worked there, you know, worked so hard to build something that it's over. It's awful. And yeah, that was a total drag and not fun at all.
When KISS switched to Jack FM, they fired everybody. I was like one of a few people that they kept on board. So I was fortunate enough to still have a job, but under the Jack FM umbrella, and I was doing some producing. And then I eventually became a producer for the morning show at the time that they had hired. It was a guy named Rob Christie. So I was producing for his show. And for the amount of time that I was there, I was just miserable, right? Like, my heart wasn't in it, but I had to work. I had to make a living.
When KISS left, it was devastating for everyone. And I was offered to stay, and it just wasn't my thing. And I got this opportunity to go and host a television show. It was a late night show called Last Call on a brand new station called Toronto One, this like upstart.
Last Call.
I'll always support people as best as I can, whether they're part of the team that I'm part of or whether they want to go off and do something that's good for them and their family.
Julie was so incredibly gracious that I didn't know anything about contracts and I didn't know any of this stuff. And I was working for Julie and I said, hey, I want to go and I want to leave you and I want to go and work for this other company and do this other show. But I'm really in a jam here because I don't know anything about contracts. And Julie was like, ugh, send me your contract.
He wanted to make this move and he needed a little help. And I was happy to, I was happy to help him because, you know, I knew that this is what he wanted. And, you know, trying to argue with somebody about how what they want isn't what you want. Like, of course, I didn't want Roz to leave. But keeping him at the radio station when he wanted to go on and do something else wasn't helpful. I mean, there's no point to that.
So Julie actually helped me going through my new contract so I didn't get screwed while quitting on her. Like, that's how amazing Julie is. Can you imagine that?
He knew what he wanted to do. And so I wanted to help him get where he wanted to get to. I wanted him to be, if there's anything I could do for him or for Mocha at any time, I would always do that for them.
I just wanted to have fun because I realized that when you're putting off everything, you know, grieving or any sort of mental health stuff, having fun was my escape. And so I never wanted to engage in any sort of reality. You know, make-believe and fantasy sort of became my world. That's why television fit so perfectly for me, right? Was because it was phony. It was make-believe. There was nothing authentic about it, but only I was me on there, but I didn't have to be the real me. And I got very good at not being the real me. So I went and I did this late night show and the reviews for it, like, oh my God, the Globe and Mail just ravaged it. And I swear, people still bring up that show to me. Like, that's how crazy it was. That's how legendary it was. And it wasn't even on for a full year.
Walking into work every single day, knowing it was Jack FM, but not Kiss, but my surroundings were kind of the same. Something inside of me, I just kept hoping, oh man, like one day this frequency is going to switch back to Kiss. And I want to be here for it. But that obviously wasn't a reality at the time. I kind of hated it, but I needed to work.
Yes, I knew Mocha was going to thrive. You know, absolutely.
Yeah, I was pissed at Julie, but because I look at her as like a mentor and someone who I admire and took a lot of direction from in my career, the sadness, I guess, or the hate, not really hate, but the disappointment didn't last very long because I trusted her.
He's such a kind person and such a good human being. You know, after meeting him and seeing what he would go through to get a job and how passionate he was and how hardworking he was. And it didn't matter what I threw at Mocha. You know, he was successful at it.
I got an opportunity to work at a radio station in Calgary that was very much like Kiss in Toronto. 8 months later, they decided to change that format to Jack FM. So that's a second Jack FM format flip that I was a part of. Funny enough, when I come back, the running joke was, hey, I'm the reason they keep switching Kiss to Jack FM. Everyone else thought it was hilarious, but I didn't.
Over the next 6 years, both Roz and Mocha would thrive in opposite directions.
91.5 The Beat, KW's new hit music station. Lil Jon and the Eastside Boys, what you gon' do?
Mocha returned to Southern Ontario and built his own morning show on The Beat in Kitchener.
Mocha-licious definition, still ain't got no girlfriend. It looks like I'll be single all the way up until the end.
In 2005, Roz became one of the faces of Entertainment Tonight Canada.
When I started on ET Canada, it wasn't even ET Canada. They hadn't even named the show yet.
Watch Roz Weston weeknights on ET Canada.
But June 5th, 2009 was the day that changed everything.
We used to listen to the mix.
I used to listen to Energy 108.
The Stern always in the morning.
Hits 103.5.
Chama
103.9.
Kiss was back.
Kiss 92.5.
Toronto's number one
station. Coming up on the next episode of The History of Roz and Mocha.
The year before we started this show, I was in a very different place in my life.
I decided that, you know, that was the person that should lead the morning show.
I never said out loud that if Kiss ever came back, that I would go back. In my heart, I knew it.
Not all casts are put together in the same way.
I just had this moment where I was like, who am I going to do this show with?
I got a call from Julie saying, hey, would you like to come back to Toronto? And I was like, absolutely yes.
And when I heard Mocha, I realized what exactly I was looking for. And I was looking for everything.
I immediately said no.
He said no. Now what are we going to do?
I felt like the show had already failed and we hadn't even built it yet.